lunatics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, Trey, how are you doing today?
It's a wonderful day, and I hear that we have some new supporters that make the day even a little bit better. Would you tell me about them?
Yeah, absolutely. We have two new Patreon monthly sustaining supporters, and they are Linda and Tim. So I wanted to give them a little shout out and say thank you so much for helping us keep the show going. And of course, as you know, Linda and Tim, as monthly sustaining supporters, get more than just the shout out. They will have access every week to the bonus shows that we do. And, you know, at various levels, there are all kinds of other things folks can get. And if you're interested in that, you can just check it all out at patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can just go to our website, politicsguys.com/support.
We really appreciate you, and we hope that you'll join us this week for a bonus show where we're going to be talking a little bit about racism and Donald Trump. To start this show, Mike, I would like to take us off. I think the thing that many of our listeners are interested in and is your take on the Democratic debates. We had two nights of debates this week. And I have some takes on this, but I would like to really start with you because you're the one who's going to be voting in a Democratic primary, right? I'm just a spectator. So why don't we start? What was your take? And I know that you have even a ranking about how you see the candidates personally, and I'd be interested to hear about that as well.
Yeah, well, what I thought is we could talk about my take and then maybe at the end sort of the ranking thing. But here's my quick take, my ultra quick take. Tuesday, Rise of the Moderates. Wednesday, Pile on Joe. That's my super quick take. Now there's more to it, obviously, than that. And I got to say, you know, after the first debates, a couple listeners said, you know, Mike, a lot of what you did was just talk about why you hate the debate format. So I won't do that again. Not really. But of course, I will mention, as I know you will agree, Trey, is that 60 seconds for an answer, 30 seconds for rebuttal, that kind of thing. We're not really talking about a debate. But that aside, I will get off that soapbox that I so love to get on and talk more substantively about that. So here we go. From night one on Tuesday, I think to me, the comment that just caught my attention the most came from John Delaney, who we're not going to hear much more from, I don't think, when he said, I think Democrats win when we run on real solutions, not impossible promises. We run on things that are workable, not fairy tale economics. Now, my first thought, Trey, when I heard that was like, yes. But then my second thought immediately was like, do you know the American electorate exactly? because totally what I want to hear, but totally unrealistic. And then, of course, I think Elizabeth Warren hit the nail on the head in her response when she said, I don't understand why anyone goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we can't do and shouldn't fight for. Now, and again, I think both of them are absolutely right, but you have to sort of combine those two views. And I think it's best combined in something that former New York Governor Mario Cuomo said many years ago. He said, you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. And the poetry part of it is, yes, you know, when you're campaigning, you have these grand plans and things that get people excited and so forth. And Warren is right that talking about all these things that you can't really do and being very pragmatic, you know, that's not going to excite voters, especially primary voters. But Delaney's right when it comes to governing. And so to me, we need an ideal combination sort of Warren and Delaney, or really, and this kind of exemplifies what I see as, and what a lot of people see as, the split in the Democratic Party. You have these fiery progressive with all these just grand ideas, these, you know, in many cases, I would argue great ideas, but we know, and this is what the moderates are saying, we know for a fact that there aren't going to be the votes to make these things happen. And so how do we combine the idealism and the pragmatism? And to me, that's really at the heart of a lot of these struggles in the Democratic Party. And I think we saw that both on Tuesday and on Wednesday.
It's interesting that you put it that way, Mike, because from my outsider perspective, taking a look at this, what kind of summed it up for me, I've got a good friend. He's a Beltway guy. He has worked for a long time in Washington. He's on the Democratic side of the aisle, and he watched both nights, and he, I think he put it best. I'm actually just going to use him. He said, really, what the election is shaping up to be is wall 2.0 or free shit. And that really kind of feels to me, the Democratic debate was, who is going to be, we got a few people trying to coming in at the moderate level. But in general here, we're talking about what can we do? What are we going to give away? Who's going to give away the best stuff? And I don't really think that that's a great attack on Donald Trump. And another thing that's kind of bothered me about both evenings was I didn't see any of the challengers suggesting that Trump had taken the presidency too far. Rather, they're just arguing that he's not wielding the power that he's grabbed the way.
Yeah.
And, both of those strike me as deeply, deeply problematic. What do you think about that yourself from your side of the aisle?
Well, I completely agree. And I think this is one of these things that almost all of us on the show agree. I mean, all of us who host the show at least agree with is there's a widespread concern about too much presidential power and not enough congressional assertion of their authority as the framers saw it as the first branch. And so, what I hear from a lot of these candidates is, I will issue these executive orders and do these big things. And I think, oh, my God, this is the last thing that I really want. And so, I have a big problem with that as well. I'm right on board with you there.
Especially with Warren and Sanders, given that they're senators. Yeah. I mean, they're currently, on the one hand, battling that in the Senate, but then on the other saying, well, but when I'm in it, give me a pass.
Yeah. But here's what I wonder, though, because obviously now Bernie Sanders, we'll get to this, I think, when I talk about my rankings. But Bernie Sanders, maybe, but certainly Elizabeth Warren, they understand the Senate. They've been in the process for a long time. And I think Warren is, for a number of reasons, a more serious candidate, would make a much better president. But Elizabeth Warren particularly has to know that, I mean, she is, of course, the candidate with the plan. She's got a plan for everything. But Elizabeth Warren has to know, given the reality, the electoral realities, that she is not going to be able to do these things. And so what I'm thinking is that Elizabeth Warren maybe is using this as essentially for bargaining. Like, for instance, you start with Medicare for All. Then you bargain down to a public option, to an Obamacare redo with a public option, which is, of course, what Obama wanted in the first place. He started with that and bargained that away, basically. And so from a strategic standpoint, maybe that makes sense, assuming that it doesn't scare off enough people that you just end up with a Donald Trump for four more years, which, is obviously one of the things that a lot of moderates in the Democratic Party are concerned about. So I think Elizabeth Warren understands this. I don't know if Bernie Sanders does, which is weird because Bernie Sanders has been in Congress for a long time. But I think Bernie Sanders is just sort of fundamentally deluded, or at least it seems that way. I love Bernie, and I think he's a great gadfly to have and a great sort of progressive conscience of the party. But my gosh, I think he would make an awful president for exactly those reasons, but that's not to say I don't like him. The other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was Joe Biden, obviously, because he's the presumptive favorite still. A couple of things. Number one is, he has been attacked for having different policies or for flip-flopping over time. And to me, in a way, I certainly want Joe Biden to be called to account for changing his views on things. But what would worry me even more would be if Joe Biden still held the same positions on issues that he held in the 1970s and 1980s, because the world has changed quite a lot. And to me, a candidate who doesn't, or a politician who doesn't recognize changing realities and adjust his or her views that would be much more worrisome. So, of course, I want to hear, you know, for instance, on the crime thing, which is where I think Booker, you know, scored a lot on Biden, if we want to talk about it in those terms. So given the context of the rise in crime in the 1990s and the deep concerns back then, I think those policies make a lot more sense in context of the time. But we saw, I think, that a lot of those policies were an overreaction. So that doesn't mean I don't think that Biden was necessarily wrong, given what we knew or what we thought we knew about crime back then. But certainly you need to say, well, okay, I wouldn't do that again, given what I know now. And so I think in a way, the attacks are a bit overmuch, are a bit unfair, given the fact that that sort of Monday morning quarterback hindsight of literally decades is, you know, sort of unfair in a way.
I'm very glad that you bring that up, because it is true. There is this assumption that what will make a good leader is one who never shifts, who never changes. But when you're talking about somebody like Biden, who's been in the public eye so long, as a matter of fact, I don't think anybody in the early 1980s was going to predict the major shifts that changes, and what we now know to be changes in abortion policy and changes, ironically, in lead paint policy, were going to have such major impacts on crime rates. That was all there was. I mean, that was the looming threat, was crime. And so one of the problems is looking at Biden's decisions in the past through the lens of what's occurring to you now, one of the safest times in American history, in large part due to just two unrelated policy changes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's that. There's also, obviously, if you were a betting person, it would be smart to bet on Biden as the nominee. And that worries me for a couple of reasons. But I've talked about the age thing before. Now, I think Biden looked better in the second debate, looked sharper than he did in the first debate. Now, that was a lot of room for improvement, certainly. But I don't think he seemed as much in command as I'd like to see. And I guess in a way, here's where our incredibly insane primary process is maybe a good thing, because I think if he truly can't handle the rigors, we'll see that. You know, the campaign will wear him down if he truly is Sleepy Joe, as, you know, Donald Trump likes to call him. Because after all, he's 76 years old, you know, and so I think the campaign will bear that out or not. But to me, that is, you know, that's certainly something worth keeping in mind, and we'll be able to tell over time. Now, the one other thing I wanted to mention about Biden is, and here's where I think there is a more substantive critique, is on immigration. And here's where I disagree with him. I think he either misunderstood a policy, or maybe whether accidentally or on purpose, where he kept on saying, you know, if you're in here illegally, you should be sent back. And I think his statement on that misunderstood what a lot of the other candidates were saying, is they're not for making immigration, illegal entry, legal, therefore decriminalizing it, which is a very different thing. Because it wouldn't make it illegal, it wouldn't make it legal, it would make it a civil, not a criminal offense, which means, and here's the big thing, is you wouldn't be able to lock people up for it. And I don't get the sense that Biden, like I said, that he either understood the distinction, or that he, or maybe he wanted to gloss over the distinction or something. But so, I mean, I certainly would favor something that's closer to decriminalization, but not necessarily, certainly not making illegal entry legal entry, basically. You know?
I think he was trying to gloss over that, because when you look at the hard numbers, President Obama had deported more people so far than Donald Trump has, despite the differences in rhetoric. Yeah. And I don't think he wants to scratch too hard at that particular fact. And so I don't think it was an accident that he's posing it in that direction, because then when you look at that number, it makes his time as vice president and Barack Obama's time as president look in a much more favorable light. And again, I don't think we'd even be talking about them having that high number if it wasn't for the rhetoric of Donald Trump, which is, I would say, an unfortunate case where rhetoric has become more important than the actual policy outcomes.
Yeah. You know, and on the Obama thing, I think this is another point. I think Booker was the one, maybe it was Booker who made this point, saying, you know, you can't sort of hide behind Barack Obama when it's convenient for you. But then when you're called out on his policies, say, well, you know, I can't really say what I said to him. And I wasn't the president. I was just the vice president. So, and I think that's a fair criticism. So, you know, I'm very torn here, Trey, I guess is my point. And maybe this gets into my ranking issue, is that I like Biden for a lot of reasons. And maybe if it's okay, can we kind of shift into this?
Because yes,
I think this kind of gets into.
Let's talk about that rank.
So, you know, I have essentially three criteria, or my three main criteria, at least. And number one is electability. That's my number one priority, because I believe that any of these candidates, even Marianne Williamson, would be preferable to Donald Trump, if for no other reason, for judges. And this is exactly the same reason, of course, so many Republicans.
I was going to say, are you just playing into our Republican friends' hands there? Because, I mean,
no,
really,
I mean,
that's the woman who, you know, she thinks that with a little bit of self-help, the depression goes away. And it's all we need
is
some essential oils.
I mean, I cannot imagine if she were in some bizarre world, if she were the nominee, and I had to choose between Williamson and Trump, that would be rough, you know. But it would probably come down to judges and, you know, some other things like that. But my point being is that I think that almost anyone who's a legitimate candidate would be better than Donald Trump. And again, this is the logic that a lot of Republicans use, I know, who weren't anti-Trump Republicans. Now, I think it's when we talk about electability, one of my old friends from grad school pointed out, you know, what we used to think of as electability is a lot different than what it is now. And take a look at Donald Trump, for instance, right? And so I think that's fair. And when we look at the field that we have now in terms of electability, I think maybe the only person who I would sort of just basically shut down on that grounds at all, who I don't necessarily think is electability, would be maybe Williamson. You could make an argument for Sanders, and here's where a lot of folks who are to the left of me would disagree. But I think that sort of socialist thing that would come up would be certainly a barrier. And others might make an argument for Buttigieg, and, you know, because obviously, is the country ready for an openly gay president? I would certainly hope so. You know, there's suggestion we've had, you know, maybe at least one closeted gay president, but, you know, it's a reasonable question to bring up, certainly. So anyway, that's electability. But more substantively, is policy, and not just policy positions I agree with, but a viable roadmap to making these positions a reality, given what we know about the current political environment.
You know? So not just the Sanders, hey, this is what I like the most, but rather which ones you think are doable is what you're saying.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it was it the Senate night, Jay Inslee made the point of, you know, well, our problem, no matter which of us gets elected, assuming one of us gets elected, is going to be Mitch McConnell, basically. And that, you know, because even if we hold the House, which seems a reasonable bet that Democrats are odds on favor to hold the House. But the Senate, I don't think Democrats are going to win the Senate. And even if they do, there's not a filibuster proof majority. So I think that's an important point to make. And to me, a policy without a plan to implement it is not terrifically useful. And as you and I talked about just a minute ago, that plan for me better not be, well, let's just expand executive power. You know, for reasons that we talked about, because if you expand it for Pete Buttigieg, then you expand it for Donald Trump, whoever comes after. And I think that's one of the main problems with our system is too much executive power. So right away, that gives me some issues with pretty much all of the candidates, really, right?
Yeah, I would agree.
Then there's experience. I would say if Donald Trump has taught us nothing else, it's that the presidency is not sort of an entry-level position There's an incredibly steep learning curve, right? And I think this has actually been to the benefit of a lot of people on the left, because I believe it's the, you know, I guess you could call it the incompetence of the administration. And I think there's part of that, or the erraticism of Donald Trump, but also just the fact that knowing how things work is awfully important. And
well, can I add something there for you, Mike? Because I think it's more than that. Absolutely. I think it's the willingness to read.
Yeah, the willingness to learn.
Exactly.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because when you're talking about that kind of coming in, I don't think it's so much as you come in with all of the skill sets you have to have, but rather you have demonstrated the ability and the willingness to learn and understand those skill sets as you come into the job, just to kind of put a slightly different take on what you're saying there.
No, I told that sort of, in a way, it's kind of a sort of humility, which is not the kind of word you'd associate with most politicians, but especially not the current occupant of the Oval Office, but kind of a, well, what don't I know? And, you know, basically up on what you don't know. And that's a difficult thing, certainly. So yeah, I totally agree with you there. But, you know, and I think executive experience is important, particularly if you've worked with a divided legislature to get things done. And also, though, I would argue that congressional experience, because the United States Congress is a very unique body, and knowing its ins and outs certainly is a huge help. And not just saying, well, I've been there, but I've been there and I've actually worked to make things happen. Like, for instance, Bernie Sanders has been there forever. But in terms of trying to find, you know, things that Bernie Sanders has done, that's a little bit harder than it is for some other members, just because of the sort of person, sort of positions Bernie Sanders has, essentially, right? And so those are my three criteria: electability, policy, and experience. But even if I like someone, all of those criteria, if they're not getting any traction, to me, they're not a viable choice. And so when I look at the candidates right now, basically, there are a bunch of them that are polling at 1% or less. And to me, unless there's some sort of a miraculous sort of thing, right now, if you're polling at 1% or less, I think history tells us that you're not going to be the nominee. And so I'm not going to focus a whole lot on those people. And that cuts out some people that otherwise I would really like.
As a matter of fact, has there ever been a 1% poller at this juncture who has moved forward?
I don't think so.
I hadn't looked it up, but I don't believe so off the top of my head.
I mean, it's kind of a small N issue, right? Because we can only go back to the 50s and there aren't a lot of candidates. But still, yeah, I don't think so. And so that means, like, I think that Bennett said some great things. I think Bullock said some great things. I've been a Hickenlooper fan from the beginning. Inslee, I think, has had a lot of important things. But they're just not going to be there, even in a few months. They're not even going to make the next debate, essentially. So who that leaves me with is, to me, basically there are five viable candidates at this point. And I think it's going to come down to these five. And to me, my ranking of these five candidates is Buttigieg, Biden, Booker, Harris, and Warren. That's kind of the order that I would vote for them in if given the chance, you know? And I mean, the thing I like about Buttigieg is his focus has been much more than the other candidates on process. It's been sort of in order for us to get things that we want to get done as Democrats, we have to focus much more on reforming the political system. And I've listened a lot to him talk a lot about this, basically saying that without this kind of reform, without making sure that the people's voices are heard and we have the structures in place to do that, our agenda is going to stall out. And I really like the fact that he has brought that front and center. And to me, he's done that much more than any other candidates. Warren's done some of it, but that's just because Warren's got a plan for everything, essentially. So yeah, I like that about him, and that's why he's my first choice. Biden after him, because Biden, I think, more than anyone else, has that sort of depth of experience and realization of what can happen. And then kind of Booker, Booker had that mayoral experience, and I like that, at least some sort of executive experience. He's been in the Senate since 2013, so he kind of knows how the Senate works. Harris, she's only been a senator since 2017. I'm not crazy about that, certainly. And Warren is just a little too far left for me, basically. And so that's kind of how it breaks down for me, at least.
You know, I can hear it now, but I was shocked that Warren came at the bottom of your list.
Well, you know, I so admire her intelligence. I think she has so many great things to say, but I think her policy proposals are just too far left to be viable. And so I think someone like a Booker or even a Harris, I see them as being not quite as far left. And I mean, for years now, Warren has kind of set herself up as sort of, I would say, a less radical version of Bernie Sanders, basically. And I think that makes sense as a primary strategy. And I think it's important. I think it's incredibly important to have people like that in the Democratic Party. But I don't think that is the sort of voice, the sort of person that I want leading the party, because I think there needs to be a more centrist voice. I mean, that's why I loved Barack Obama. I mean, Obama was center left. He was further to the left than Bill Clinton, but he, you know, certainly he's further to the right than most of the 2020 candidates. And you know, my gosh, I would love to vote for Barack Obama again. You know, you know. And I understand Biden's making the argument that, well, I'm just kind of like an older, whiter version of Barack Obama. I don't buy it. My idea would be a third Obama term. But thanks to Republicans in Congress back in the day, I don't get that option, unfortunately. So, yeah.
I have to admit, I'm a little shocked at how close we come. I would have put Booker at number one personally. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. I couldn't. If the election were between Booker and Donald Trump, I would vote for Booker. Because I think that he can be a moderate enough voice. And I think that on trade issues, he would actually be closer to me than a Donald Trump.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that I kind of wished, you know, that's why it was so interesting when you were talking about Warren being too far to the left. That's what throws me off with a Sanders or a Warren, because their trade policy is effectively Donald Trump, but with not tweeting nastily about it. And it's a disaster. That is a disaster. I'm sorry to Democrats who don't like to hear that, but that is the same thing that Donald Trump is giving you, just with a different packaging, right? So I would agree. I would love to see somebody like Booker win, so that not Trumpers could vote for the alternative, because you're not going to get that with a Sanders or a Warren. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I would stay home, or I'm in a third party vote rather than go with somebody who's going to give me the same exact policies I don't like, plus judges I don't like. Right.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Biden stumbles and, Buttigieg has been great in terms of fundraising, but he's had sort of problems translating that into support, especially in the African-American community. And so, you know, I could easily see a situation in which Booker kind of rises up, though right now he's at, you know, 1.7%. So he's got a ways to go, and he may not be the guy, you know, but for me, I could see in a couple of months Booker being my main choice. But for right now, I'm with Pete.
I can understand. Well, if we now have Mike's full list, and this it will be, there is something kind of just intrinsically gripping about the early stages of who can win and why do people gravitate towards them. I will say that.
Can I make an admission? And this is sort of a guilty pleasure kind of admission, but I like so much about Pete Buttigieg. I mean, the experience thing is the big thing that I am obviously super concerned about, and that, you know, and when push comes to shove, that may push him down in my rankings as we go forward. So I'm open to that. But honestly, the image, I have this image in my mind, Trey, and it's just this image of President President Buttigieg having taken the oath, turning to his husband, giving him a kiss, and just watching and just thinking of the heads exploding across the country. I gotta say, it fills me with a certain just joy and glee. And I know I shouldn't feel that way, but sometimes in darker moments, I think about that and it makes me feel so happy. So I just had to say that. So anyway,
well, if you were a Star Trek fan, you'd already would have had that. We had Discovery. We had our moment. So it would be fitting, okay, right? We get Discovery in 2018, with the first kiss, and then you'd get Pete and,
There you go. Anyway, it's a visual that just makes me smile whenever I think about it. I know we need to move on.
Well, to take us deeply away from the horse race narrative of presidential races, let's turn to a really big policy shift this week. And that was the Federal Reserve cutting the interest rate a quarter of a point. And this is going to be the first time it's happened since the recession in 2008. Now, Powell he's kind of said a reason, but there's really only two big reasons why we're seeing this kind of monetary policy right now, a rate cut. One is that Powell is bowing to Trump monetary pressure, right? Trump has wanted rate cuts. He sees the Fed as holding back this rocket ship of an economy, and if only they would be different, we'd do it. So this could be about a political pressure, or we could kind of take Powell at more of his word and say that this is the Fed responding to the China tariffs, another policy that we're going to talk about here as a story later on in the show. He himself even said, quote, that the cut is an insurance policy against potential speed bumps for the economy, including rising trade tensions and a slowdown in global growth, end quote. So what do you think about the interest rate policy, both on in terms, Mike, of where it's coming from, the purpose, why are we doing it now, and will it have the effect that Powell and the Fed wants?
Well, I totally agree with you in terms of the analysis part and the reasoning, and I understand the reasoning, but I am with the two of the 10 members on the rate setting committee who dissented, which, by the way, that's a pretty big deal. Actually, we usually don't see that amount of dissent, but I think this is a bad move. I think this is a very bad move for a couple of reasons, at least. Number one, the economy still, by a lot of indicators, is pretty strong. We had the jobs report come out. You know, wages are up 3.2% from this time last year, 164,000 new jobs. Unemployment is steady at an ultra low, right, 3.7%. Now, there are, you know, you mentioned the trade thing, and there are some indications of a manufacturing investment slowdown, I think related, as you suggested, largely to the trade thing. If you think about it, well, there are a couple of reasons why I think this is an awful idea. Number one, this gives the Fed already has what's called a short runway, which means that if there's a real turndown, it doesn't have a whole lot that it can do to get us out of a serious downturn in the economy. If you look back at the last three recessions, before the financial crisis, we were at 4.25%. Before the dot-com 9/11 recession, interest rates were at 5.31%. And before the 1990 recession, they were at over 8%, which meant that the Fed could do an awful lot to kind of inject some stimulus into the economy. And in fact, I went back as far as the Federal Reserve's data let me go, which was to the mid-50s. We've never had this low of an interest rate cushion to work with. And we've also never had a longer period of ultra low interest rates. And that's the second problem, because there's a lot of new research showing that the longer you have interest rates at a super low rate, the less of an impact lowering them is going to have, because the people who are already going to invest, buy things, refinance, they've already largely done that. So I don't think this move is going to make much of a difference. And I think you could potentially damage things in the long run when we don't have the ability to make the sort of injection of stimulus that we might need for a real turndown. So I think this was a really bad move. And you know, not only that, but I think it gets into that issue, and you'll probably appreciate this. What fiscal conservatives say is, if you just keep on flooding the system with cheap money for years and years, now for essentially a decade, you eventually pay the price, not only the potential for an inflationary blowback, which we haven't seen yet, obviously, but also those low interest rates, that cheap money, that keeps essentially zombie companies, zombie financial industries hanging on because they can borrow at super cheap rates when the normal process of creative destruction would have had them go out of business. And so I think this in the end actually may have a bit of a drag on productivity and growth. So for all of those reasons, you can tell, Trey, I'm pretty passionate about this. I think this was a horrible decision.
Well, we're not going to have a lot of disagreement on this one. If you take a look at the markets closing yesterday, the markets agreed. Generally, when you have rate cuts, you're going to see an uptick in the major indices. And instead, we saw a statistically significant downtick in the major industries, which is the inverse of what one would ought to be expecting. But I'm going to take and make even maybe a broader point here. I really do think a lot of this is Powell bowing to Trump monetary pressure, despite what he's saying.
Yeah.
And I think that it indicates this is when it's unfortunate because many libertarians take what I like to call the bunker policy. What they think is like they always think that the global economy is going to fall apart because we have a Fed and then it's all over. And if you don't have all your money in gold, well, then. You know, I'm sure
yeah,
you've
money
seen
is evil. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's the end of the world. And it's unfortunate because I think that we just gloss over the position that this kind of policymaking is fundamentally flawed. I think that having the Federal Reserve is being this outside private quasi-private company is simply a way to mask the fact that it really is, in fact, political pressure, because as you've noted, and I think as any economist can see, there's no real good reason to be cutting the rate, even if you're going to take a Keynesian economic point of view. And you're absolutely right. If you continue to flood the market with money, it's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when. You can only do that so long. Again, that's just a basic economic principle. You can be a liberal, you can be a conservative. We can agree on that. I don't know where we go from here. And again, if you're going to take Keynesian economics seriously, you're right. By keeping the rate effectively as near zero as possible, you can't do anything to it, which means what's ironic about that is what you're doing is you're putting it into a situation where it's almost like not having a Fed, which is the very thing that most people say that we can't live without. So it's a bizarre circumstance for me to, on the one hand, say, well, we have to have this institution, but to then have that institution taking a policy that makes anything it can do ineffective.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is one of these instances where I wish that we actually did like a video thing. Now, I have a face designed for audio only, but because I'd love to show people the chart from the St. Louis Fed is just a financial geek sort of paradise because they have all these charts. And one of them that I look at all the time is the effective federal funds rate, which is essentially when we talk about the interest rate. And if you were to see that, you would understand immediately how strange this period is. In fact, Trey, if you don't mind, maybe we could put up a link to that in the show notes, because it's really just, you look at that and you're like, wow, this is very, very different and kind of troubling. And the other point I'd want to make is, this gets to the point, I know this is one of Jay's favorite points, is the big problem here, I think, is uncertainty. And the Trump policies in so many areas, but especially in terms of trade and economic policy, have been so erratic, using tariffs as kind of a political tool, is deeply problematic. And because businesses, industry hates uncertainty. And that's if you want to slow growth, if you want to get businesses to just kind of lock up, the best thing to do is to design an uncertain environment, which I think is exactly what has been happening. And so the Fed, in part, I would disagree with you to a certain extent. I think that Powell's a little more independent, but I think the Fed just has never, in recent memory, has never had a deal with an economic policy coming out of the White House that's just so incredibly erratic, which to me gets back to another argument about congressional authority, because it's not like the president just this is an inherent presidential authority to impose tariffs and that. That's an authority that Congress gave the president. And I think it's high time that that's an authority that Congress take back.
I can't agree enough on that last one. As a matter of fact, why don't we kind of segue into that? Because what leads to all of this is Trump tweeting. It's funny and it's easy to kind of make a joke about it, but it is unfortunate to me how often that I'm leading a story with on Thursday Trump tweeted, and then it has these impacts. But here we go. On Thursday, Trump tweeted that he's going to impose a 10% tax on $3 billion worth of Chinese imports. And this time we are talking about almost solely consumer goods, t-shirts, toys, televisions, phones, right down the line, beginning on September 1st. Now, to this point, consumers have largely, but not entirely, been shielded from earlier tariffs. And that's because they weren't directly on the things that you would be buying as a consumer. However, if you take a look at the analysis by Goldman Sachs, which is what I was kind of doing this week, this is kind of my wheelhouse, 60%+ of the items affected are going to be consumer goods, which means you're going to see a direct increase. And this is the time of year. I know it's unusual. You're thinking, well, it's the beginning of August, but this is the time of the year that things that you're producing go into the area of the holiday buying season. So what happens right now, what happens in September are going to affect those times. And meanwhile, we have China responding on Friday, threatening that they're going to have new threats as a result of this potential tariff increase, because they argue that it's a violation of the earlier agreement during the G20. And to make things even more political, Mike, they're also blaming the U.S. for the ongoing issues in Hong Kong, and they've kind of mushed these two things together. So there's a lot to talk about here. What do you think about this, I'll call it the next level up in the China-U.S. Tariff battle? And do you think this means we're going to end up with a no deal?
Well, I think that the administration's policy or view on this was best summed up by Peter Navarro. He was on a Fox Business this week, and he said, "We love tariffs. Tariffs are a wonderful thing." And I, smacked my head, said, "Oh my God!" that's the view. Obviously, the Trump administration is pushing this false narrative that China is just simply eating all of these losses. And we know it's a false narrative because that's not what American businesses are actually saying. They're saying, no, that is not the case, actually. We are feeling the pain for this, and we're going to feel it more. So that's just flat out untrue. I guess I'm a little conflicted on this, because I agree to a certain extent with the administration on goals. I don't agree with deals that would force China to buy American goods, because I think that's something that market prices should basically, dictate, and not sort of by some sort of agreement between governments. But I think the idea of keeping the trade sort of playing field as level as possible, absolutely, I'm for that. I'm for a big crackdown on China's just egregious intellectual property abuses and anything that makes it much more difficult for U.S. companies to enter Chinese markets than it is for Chinese companies to enter U.S. markets. So I'm with the administration on that. I think that we need to address that. And the longer we wait, the bigger China's economy gets relative to us, the harder it is. I think it's something that should have been addressed in the Obama administration, if not before. But, we're at where we're at, essentially. And I also agree that in some industries, we have some very real security concerns, especially given the fact that Huawei can say what they want, but do we know that the Chinese government won't have access or won't tell them to put some sort of a backdoor into things? No, and I don't trust Huawei on that. Why would I, given that China's an authoritarian state? So I have a lot of sympathy with the administration's goals, but the just sort of erratic, again, there's that word, way that they're approaching things, I think just makes very little sense, this erratic and unilateral way of approaching it. That isn't the way to do it. I think you do it through a much tougher stance in multilateral negotiations. You work through the WTO, something that previous administrations have done, though I would say they haven't been nearly as aggressive about it as they should have been. So that's what I'd like to see. So I agree in goals, but not in process, I guess I'd say, with the administration.
No, I hear where you're coming from. And that is, in fact, I think one of the issues with the China issue is that there are problems with China. And you mentioned the intellectual property. That is a giant issue for American companies because that's where we make the bulk of our money. As a matter of we don't produce tangible goods, we produce intellectual property. And that is where we've taken a hit. But the issue is that imposing larger tariffs on China and having them impose tariffs back on us isn't fixing any of those issues, and it doesn't even set it up to fix it, those issues in the future. All it sets you up to do is just to completely end trade. And I think that this could be a very kind of catastrophic moment. I don't think the average individual realizes how much more goods would cost if we didn't have trade with China.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a huge gamble, obviously, by the Trump administration. And they're being dishonest about the fact that we're not paying a price for it. And I would almost respect them more if they were to just say, well, yeah, we're going to take a hit.
Yes.
But we're willing to stick in there. And we'll see who blinks first. But to me, there's a huge problem with the logic of that, because I think by the nature of its authoritarian government, China's in a much better position to just kind of hold on and not blink first, because we have actually changes in power, which in China, you know, I think we can say that, you know, Xi Jinping is going to be in power, probably, you know, assuming there's not a death or something like that, long after Donald Trump has left the scene, or at least the people who have the same view. So we are not very well positioned to win this battle of chicken, essentially, I don't think, with China. And if we had done this a decade ago, when China's economy was, you know, a bit smaller, maybe we'd have been in a better position. But, you know, we didn't. And that, I say, is a flaw of the Obama administration, a big one. But we're at where we're at now. And given where we're at now, this approach to me doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Agreed. And I think we'll have to see how much of a policy impact this will have as we kind of cycle back around to the first issue. Who's going to be able to win and lose? When is this felt? Because it doesn't matter what is going to happen. It matters when the pain is felt. That's the question. And sometimes even pain isn't rightly identified. But we'll put a pin in that for now, listeners, as we move on to our final story. And that is that the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, has decided that it's time to be done. The New York Times reported that he's resigning in large part because he has found his warnings to be either suppressed or ignored by the White House of Russian interference in elections. And then to give the story an additional twist, yesterday, the presumed nominee, Congressman John Ratcliffe, actually withdrew his name on Friday from consideration following some media scrutiny over his role. President Trump tweeted that Ratcliffe, quote, was being treated very unfairly by the lamestream media, end quote, and that he's going to be nominating someone else shortly. So what do you think both about Coates' resignation, but then on top of that, Mike, Ratcliffe's withdrawal before even really getting into the process?
Yeah. Well, I think that Dan Coats was the least experienced director of national intelligence to hold the position since it was created. And that was, of course, after 9/11. But he at least had focused on defense and security issues while in the Senate. And I think despite his, what I would think, less than ideal amount of experience, he was a serious guy and he took the job seriously and did the main thing the job required. He told the president what the consensus view of the Intelligence Committee was on key issues, whether the president wanted to hear that view, that truth or not. You know, he pushed back against Trump comments on Russian interference, on whether North Korea would be willing to abandon its nuclear program, on whether Iran was adhering to the nuclear agreement, if ISIS was still a threat, a bunch of things like that. And of course, that put him on the outs with the president. And it seems pretty clear to me that in nominating Ratcliffe, we get a sign from Donald Trump the kind of person he wants. He wants to surround himself with people who are Donald Trump loyalists first and foremost. And we'll see who the president points to, you know, replace Ratcliffe, who was, you know, clearly not at all qualified for the position. And in fact, he resigned because all of a sudden his misstatements, his exaggerations, I'll be charitable, about his previous experience came to light. But it's important, especially in this position, to have somebody who's going to be an honest broker, to use the awful old cliche to speak truth to power. And this is, of course, I think a big problem with Donald Trump is when he has brought people into his administration who are willing to tell him things that he doesn't want to hear, he tries to get rid of these people because he is not good at hearing things he doesn't want to hear.
It's true. And from every indication we have, it's not even so much that he doesn't ignore it, but rather it's even more fundamental than that. It doesn't penetrate his consciousness is the best way that I can put that, or at least that's what it appears as an outsider. But for me,
I just want to, on that point, Trey, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it doesn't penetrate his consciousness because, again, and this whole sort of psychoanalysis at a distance thing is always hugely iffy. But it seems to me that based on his statements and his tweets and all that, the lens through which the president views everything, more than any other president I've ever seen in my lifetime, is this a pro-Trump thing or an anti-Trump thing? Mm-hmm. And that it doesn't go much further than that. Now, of course, all politicians look at that as a primary lens, but more than anyone else I've ever seen, that almost seems to be the only lens through which President Trump can see those things. And that's where I think it goes from being a problem to being a debilitating flaw.
And you know, one last note on this is, in many ways, I see this as being a win for Ratcliffe. I still don't quite get why anybody in a relatively good position moving forward, you're a congressperson in this case, wants to jump onto the end of the Trump administration. I don't see that as being something that's going to be successful for you when we come around to the next. You don't see Trump administrator sticking around a long time, A. So even if he wins re-election, maybe not for you now. And if he loses, I don't see that as being a great CV item or a resume item as you move forward either. It still baffles me a little bit why the individuals who accept these nominations do. If I got one tomorrow, I would be hard pressed to want to do it.
Yeah.
I don't mean that in a negative way. Personally, I would love to serve the country, but it would be a difficult yeah. decision to want to do that. Last thoughts?
I would support you. I would support you, Trey, as U.S. Trade Representative, I think. But I would send you the biggest bottle of Excedrin that I could possibly find.
Yeah, I don't, you know... And there's all these kind of scenarios. Yeah. I don't think Donald Trump, and you can see too many things about me. He'd look at me and he'd say, what about this as a Trump man? Anyway, but I'll take that as a compliment. Anyway, Mike has been wonderful doing the show. And I just want to remind our listeners that as soon as Mike and I are done recording the show, we're going to be doing our special supporters exclusive show. And this week, we're going to be talking about the INF treaty withdrawal. We're going to be talking about racism related to Donald Trump. It's going to be a lot of fun. So I hope you'll join us as we talk about this week. If you're a supporter, that episode is already in your podcast app right now. All you have to do is go listen to you. And that's just one of the many supporter-only things that we've got for you. So to become a supporter or to find out more about becoming a supporter, go over and check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can go to politicsguys.com/support. If you've got a question, a comment, a correction, or just some random complaint you want to share with us, you can email us at mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where we have all kinds of interesting conversations throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguys page. We're also on Twitter at Politics Guys. Subscribing to the show really helps, and so does sharing episodes with friends, family members, colleagues, other students. So word of mouth really is the best advertising, and we greatly appreciate it. post those out. Leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast app is also a huge help. The executive producers of The Politics Guy are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Morano, Andro Masker, and Benji Fishman. Today's show was produced by Trey Orndorff. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us then.